The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm blessed with three privileges. Number one, I'm George Day and a member of the Board of Directors of the Free Library Foundation. I'm also privileged to be able to introduce our wonderful speaker tonight, Letty Pogrebin. And I am the husband of the dear departed Bobby Gaughan Day, for whom this lecture is named. And each of these is a privilege, and I want to say a little bit more about them. But before I do that, the sponsor, i.e. the Free Library, has a couple of paid inserted announcements. One has to do with your cell phone. So anything that beeps, chirps, rings, gurgles, if you would kindly turn it off, that would be very appreciated. Secondly, if you are really compelled, resist the temptation to take a picture with a flash. And thirdly, if you are interested in following this whole series, and I think many of you perhaps have been part of the lecture series, you can get them now. Most of them are podcasted, and you just go to freelibrary.com, and this will be podcasted as well. So the Free Library Foundation is really the agency that funds these events and activities, and here's the paid announcement part. We're also a charitable organization, and we benefit greatly from the generosity of the community, broadly beyond Philadelphia, because this is really a regional asset, in fact, a national asset. So we welcome any gifts, any support, and continuing engagement. So thank you again for coming on behalf of the Free Library. Now, Letty Pogrebin is really quite a marvelous figure, and it's been my privilege to get to know her. She is an activist, an author, a journalist, and a woman of many parts. She has written 9 books, but is perhaps best known for being the co-founding editor of Ms. Magazine, quite an extraordinary innovation at the time in response to the kind of classic women's magazines, really charted a new path and really made an enormous and significant difference in our society. Her book today really had its genesis, as far as I can tell, and she'll speak more to that, in her work on Friends, which she started 25 years ago, so she's always been attuned to that. This book is about how to address and work with friends who are sick, and there's an enormous amount of wisdom and many useful handrails. It's partly memoir, because she's a cancer survivor, and it was her dealing with the disease and the response of her friends, and then she widened the net with a number of interviews. So I found it enormously helpful because, frankly, we're all in that situation of dealing with friends who are bereaved or ill or injured. And sometimes it's very hard to know what to do, and she provides some really phenomenal guidance on that. For me, it's also very poignant because Bobby passed away from breast cancer, and it was a tragic loss. But she would have been very, very pleased that Letty is the speaker tonight because the first book that Letty wrote was How to Make It in a Man's World. And that was Bobby. She was a remarkable person in a lot of ways, high energy, extremely attractive, but she also was a senior officer in a number of major financial firms, a very senior officer. She served on roughly 25 different boards of directors, major philanthropist, activist in her own way, in a quiet, persuasive way. So she really took to heart, I think, what Letty had written in that early book, but you'll speak to that a little bit more. So I am privileged again to welcome her here to the Free Library, and so would you put your hands together and give her a warm Philadelphia welcome. And Letty, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and good evening. I want to thank you, George, for being a wonderful dinner partner. That doesn't always come with the bargain. And for sponsoring this wonderful event. And thank you for having me, Philadelphia. I have to start by admitting that I'm someone who really loathed my birthdays, especially my decade birthdays. When I was 10, I loved being 10 because I was two numbers. When I was 20, I started life in Greenwich Village. That was a little scary, but 20 wasn't so bad. 30 was just a shock. Don't trust anyone over 30. That was the sort of anthem of my generation. 40 was a nightmare. 50, I couldn't believe. 60, I just wanted to bury myself in the sand. And then I turned 70 in 2009. And I was astonished by a transformation that was not of my own making. It just seemed to bubble out of nowhere. And that is, suddenly I felt that this glass half empty had become a bottomless jug. I suddenly was aware of all I had to be grateful for. Beauty registered on me in a big way. I felt as though every moment was precious. I sort of went into a Buddhist mode of absolute serenity. And I just have to say it was a euphoric summer for me. I turned 70 on June 9th. All summer long, my husband and I were just practically floating. We listened to music and we loved the lake and we were so engaged with life. And then came home to New York City from the country house and went to synagogue, as I do every year. And on Yom Kippur, I spend all day in synagogue trying to expiate my sins, my sinful ways. And the very next day, I went for my annual mammogram. And though you usually sit there in that ridiculous hospital gown, and after a while, the technician comes back out, after you've had your breasts pressed into a panini, the technician comes out and says, you're fine, you can get dressed. And this year, the day after Yom Kippur, 2009, the radiologist came out and said, we think we see a suspicious mass. And that catapulted me into the land of the sick, which, as George knows, becomes a full-time occupation. You suddenly care only about your own body, about tests, about doctor's visits, about blood count, about oncotype. You're suddenly very narrow-minded and very sort of shrunken in your purview. And among other things, I noticed with great fascination the responses of my friends, which were very diverse. After I made my announcement, which I made to 12 very close friends, I decided to limit it to 12. I told them, please, not to tell anybody, not because it's a secret anymore when you have cancer, but just because I didn't want, you know, I didn't want it to get out to the point where I'd have to answer all kinds of questions over and over again from more and more people. One of the things I discovered is that even when you've asked your very closest 12 friends to keep this to yourself, they tell. And suddenly, 3 days later, after that first email came out, I got an email from someone who wasn't in my intimate circle, saying all the right things, very polite, very wonderful, very caring, what can I do, I'm so sorry, all of that. But she wasn't somebody I had chosen to confide in. And then the next day, a phone call from somebody, again, not in the group, then some more emails, and then a get well card, and before you know it, news of my diagnosis had metastasized. And beyond that, I was so well aware of how one friend of mine just absolutely disappeared. She heard my news, and I never heard from her again. Another friend I saw several times a month, but she never mentioned it. Of the other 10, they were all gradations of absolutely appropriate, spot-on, pitch-perfect responses, and people who said insane things like, is it fatal? Really, the things that you hear when you're sick are absolutely beyond belief. And while I was kind of thinking through my different friends' reactions, one day in the waiting room of Sloan Kettering, when I was taking my everyday radiation treatments, I had that for 6 weeks every day, I just thought to myself, you know, I need a book to get myself through this and figure out how to relate to my friends when they're all so diverse, and some are really annoying, and some are actually insulting, and some get it completely wrong, and some keep calling and asking me how I am way past when I want to talk about how I am, and some are insensitive, and some are just oblivious. And so I wanted a book, and I took out my BlackBerry, and I punched in Friendship and Illness, and there was no such book. So I decided to write it. Being a writer, you write about things that you want to read about. But I said, I can't possibly be the only person I write about because my experience is unique. Each of our experiences is unique, especially since I had a very moderate form of breast cancer. I had a lumpectomy and not a mastectomy. I didn't suffer many of the after effects. I felt I needed to report the story. That is, as a journalist, I had to go out there and I had to interview people who were from all parts of the country, different cultural backgrounds, racial, age, so on and so on. And I said, how am I going to find these people, you know? First of all, I have cancer and I'm not exactly in the best shape. But I don't even know how to identify these people. And then I looked around the waiting room and there they were, people from all over the country. Black, white, Asian, Hispanic, people who not only were there for cancer treatments, but other treatments, and who had had every possible kind of other illness, people who came with their friends, people who came with relatives. So I said, I'm just going to ask my cohort, as they say. I'm going to ask my cohort, what have your friends done that's been helpful to you, and what hasn't? What would you recommend? How do you respond to friends who are abrasive or intrusive? And of course, since I was in the exact same boat, we were all patients, we're all vulnerable, we're all sitting there waiting to go in for our treatments, they opened up to me, kind of the way you open up to someone on an airplane who you know you'll never see again. The group that comes each day is different because the Sloan Kettering rotates you, and so you're never in the same group. When you turn up at 11 o'clock, it's a different group than you went to yesterday at 9 o'clock. So my sampling was just as broad as you could hope. And what I learned from these 80 people who I eventually interviewed buttressed my own experiences in a way that simply created a broad spectrum. The spectrum, I think, includes, if you're interested in the book, you will see that I address people who are sick in body and sick at heart. I ended up talking to people who had dealt with mental illness, a friend who was mentally ill, people who were dealing with Alzheimer's, totally unique situation, people whose friends had a sick child or a sick parent or a dying child, the worst. I have a chapter called As Bad as It Gets, which is about that absolutely tragic, unimaginable situation of losing a child and how the friends have to interact with that person in a very delicate way. I talk about death and dying and how to relate to mourners. I talked to a couple who lost all their money with Madoff because those people were sick at heart. And in fact, their health was affected. And we don't realize very often that people who have money troubles are sick, get feel sick, become sick, disturbed, troubled. I talked to people who had chronic illnesses because those people aren't getting better. It's a whole different way of relating to somebody who doesn't follow the linear norm that we think of in this culture, where you get sick, you go to the doctor, you get treated, you get well. People with chronic illnesses don't get well, and we have to learn to relate to them in a far more sensitive way than some people do. We're all ill at ease. I don't know anybody, myself included, who isn't awkward in the presence of illness. We're ill at ease in the presence of illness. What I try to do is establish a sort of baseline behavior, a policy, and that is to create absolute honesty from the very start. The minute that I, as a sick person, was diagnosed, I wish I had said to my friends, look, I want to be able to tell you exactly what I'm feeling, what I want, what I don't like, when I'd like you to back off, and when I need you. And I want you to tell me the same. I want you to say, I can't visit tonight because my kid has an exam tomorrow. Or I can't come when you're in the hospital because I hate hospitals and I'll simply feel awful and resentful that I have to be there. That sort of above board establishment of an open corridor for discussion frees you from all the pretense that's part of the old illness etiquette. The business about how we feel just show up is the best way. Well, just show up isn't always the best way. In the 80 people I interviewed, actually a few more than 80, as well as in my own experience and my husband's experience when he had hip surgery and friends who had back surgery and people I know who have had, you know, terrible ear problems, all kinds of situations in which people said, you know, I really wish people hadn't dropped in. I wish that I had been asked. I wish I wasn't always feeling I had to behave well for my visitors. There's almost a sense that you have to entertain your visitors. You have to keep them interested. It puts pressure on the sick person and their families. For example, I visited friends, Phyllis and Ira Wender, when Ira was recovering from his back surgery. And I noticed when I came in, he's somebody who had been in bed all day, but his pajamas were freshly ironed. It occurs to me, he's changed for me and my husband. He had to stop and take off the old pajamas and freshen himself up. Phyllis is running into the kitchen and making coffee. She's moving chairs so we're nearby. Our visit, which we thought we were doing for Ira's own good, actually put a bit of a strain on, in all honesty. How much better it would have been if we had been honest with each other to begin with, if I had been able to say to Phyllis on the phone, does he want visitors? I need to know the truth. Does he really want visitors, or wouldn't it be better if we wait till he's himself again and we take you guys out to dinner? That would have been an honest exchange that would have served their needs a lot better. But we felt we had to do it. We had to be the good friends. We had to fulfill the old etiquette. You show up. What I heard, I'll have to be very blunt about this, but what I heard when I first told people my diagnosis was everything from, is it terminal, to chin up, to it could be worse, to at least you have a good cancer, to God only gives you as much as you can handle. I mean, this is not helpful. How does this help me? How does this make me feel comforted? How does this speak to where I really was at that point? The people who say to someone who's lost a loved one, I know exactly how you feel. I was just that sad when my dog died. It's unbelievable, but two people actually told me that someone had said that to them. A mastectomy, a woman who had a mastectomy said that one of her friends said to her, well, at least you're married. Not helpful. Or somebody who lost a child. A friend said, at least you have two other children. Not helpful. A true test is, really, if we're able to say to ourselves, if we're able to censor just for a moment, to filter just for a moment, take a beat, don't let things plop out of our mouths, and say, is what I'm about to say something I would want to hear if I were in the same situation. It's such a basic kind of golden rule-y thing. Would it be helpful to me to hear, are you sure it's not in your head? Which people who had certain undiagnosed ills had been told because their doctors couldn't find a cause. How helpful is it to hear, are you sure it's not in your head? I counsel in this book that one of the three of the least helpful lines, which are very commonly spoken, are, how are you? Oh, my God. And you look great. We've all said it. I've said it. We certainly, how are you, is one of the most basic exchanges in public discourse. It's what you say the first time you see someone, but that's exactly what's wrong with it. Because this is not a normal situation. How are you? Or the Irish wake shake, where they really grab you by the arm. How are you? And then you say, fine, because you don't want to get into it. You don't want to talk about, you know, your 11 nodes that you're waiting to see if there's a clean margin. All these medical terms that we live with that somebody really doesn't want to hear when they say, how are you? They have to decide. The sick person has to decide right then and there. Do they really want to know? Do I really want to take the time to tell them? How detailed should I be? Or should I just say, I'm fine? That puts so much pressure on sick people. Everyone asking them, how are you? So I said to many of these interviewees, what would you have people say? And several said this. Ask me, what are you feeling? That's a question that's so different from how are you that I know you'll mean it. That I know I'll give you something real. Or I'll say to you, fine. And that will mean I really don't want to talk about it. And there are people who simply don't. People who prefer to be private. Christopher Hitchens, if you recall, was a militant atheist. He did not want to be prayed for. And yet, people formed a website called the Pray for Christopher Hitchens Day. People who felt they knew better than he did. And it was upsetting to him. He wrote about it several times in Vanity Fair, you may recall. He did not want, if he survived, he didn't, if he died, he didn't want to feel that, you know, people who prayed for him had failed. And if he survived, he didn't want them to feel that they'd, you know, actually succeeded. He felt it was too invested in a world he didn't believe in. Men very often, and there is a gender difference in responses to illness, would prefer to keep their illness secret more often than women do. In fact, I met several men who said no one knew, only their wives. They felt as if they would be emasculated by the knowledge. Men and women alike felt they would lose their jobs. They could be in peril, not get a promotion, have people staring at them at work, waiting for them to come burst out in hives or spots or weakness. Unless their hair fell out, which in most cases, in many cases of people who've had chemotherapy, they lost their hair and that became obvious. But I did talk to a man who said, I never told anybody when I went to work, even though my head hair fell out. I said, well, how could they not notice? And he said, well, I told them that I wanted to look like, who's a basketball player? Shame that, like Kanye West? No, he's a singer. One of those tall, bald basketball players who shaved everything off. And he sort of got away with that. You can see I'm not a sports fan. Sorry. But he got away with that. And he was also able to come and go. I said, how do you go for your chemo, you know, which you have to leave different times of day? And how do people not notice that you're gone at odd hours from your job? He said, I sell real estate. I go out and show, real estate properties at all kinds of times of day. No one ever had to know. There was a Hasidic man in the waiting room once who I just practically leapt on him because I thought I will never have the opportunity to talk to somebody from an impacted community like the ultra-Orthodox Jewish world. And I saw he was reading a book called The Shoah. I can read Hebrew that much. I thought, here's a man who reads a book. Maybe he'll help a woman who writes a book. And so I came up to him and asked him the same questions. How are his friends behaving? And helpful, not helpful? What do they say? And how do they make you feel? And in Judaism, there's something called Bikur Cholim, which is a requirement, a commandment to visit the sick. Now, I asked him very simply, trying to make contact through Hebrew, Yiddish, whatever I could possibly conjure. I said, well, what about Bikur Cholim? Do people visit? How often do they visit? Finally, after ignoring me, all my questions, not looking up from his book, he finally looked up and said to me, nobody knows. I told nobody. I said, you don't have anybody to confide in? My wife and Hashem, God. That's enough for me. I said to him, well, why? Why would you want to go through this all alone? You have a very tight-knit community. Long story short, he was well aware that in his community, if it got out that there was illness in the family, he would have trouble with the marriageability of his children. That judgment is made, and it's made very flatly and firmly. And so in the Orthodox Jewish community, illness is not admitted. You carry it alone. Interestingly enough, when he got up to go in for his treatment, you know, we all sit in the waiting room. All we do is wait. When you're sick, you wait for everything. Wait a long, long time. I had a long time to opportunity to talk to him. But when he went in for his treatment, a very kind of ordinary kind of, Joe College-looking guy, corduroy jacket and chinos, sat down in his place. And he gave me a piece of paper that said, a prayer for the sick. And on top of it was his phone number. It said home number. He said, if the chassid comes out while you're still here, would you please give him this and tell him he can call me? He can confide in me. I'm not in his community, but I am a rabbi. Of course, he won't think I'm a rabbi because I'm a reform rabbi. But I think if you tell him, he said, I overheard him say that he's from Krakow. Tell him my grandparents were from Krakow, and maybe he'll call me, and then he'll have a confidant. Sadly, I had to go in for my treatment before the chassid came out, so I never got to give him this wonderful piece of paper with this wonderful offer on it. But I have it in my files because it represents such a wonderful reaching out. As well as the things you don't want to hear, and let me say just a couple more examples of that. A woman who lost her husband in the collapse of the World Trade Center, he was a firefighter, was shortly after that was diagnosed with cancer. And a friend said to her, wow, you really attract bad luck. What's with your karma? Somebody else, endless numbers of people say things like, it's all in your attitude, be positive. That's not helpful. It also suggests that somehow you caused it, somehow you were negative, and it's somehow your fault. It also doesn't cure ALS or diabetes to be positive in the best of circumstances. Nora Ephron kept her illness a secret, as most of you must know, till the very end. Only 6 people knew at the time when she died. Close friends of hers were offended. They felt betrayed that she had not acted on what they thought was an intimate friendship. Nora didn't want to be cancer girl. I know that feeling. We want to be normalized. She felt if people knew, they would treat her differently, that somehow they would relate to her as if she were doomed, that she would be different in their eyes. We who are sick do not want to be different in your eyes. We want to get to the point where, as soon as possible, we can talk about capital O, capital T, other things, not ourselves, not our illness. We don't need to go over our illness. I don't need to hear 3 months after my diagnosis or my surgery. I don't need to have somebody call me up and suddenly say, I just heard. Not useful for me to have to go back. She asked me, how'd you find out? Mammography. Oh, my goodness. Did you find it yourself? Did you feel it yourself? Those are questions she asked because she wants to know. But I don't want to go back there. And neither did Nora. She did not want to have to answer those questions or relate to people as a sick person. I have a chapter on gifts. I'll tell you the very best gift story I heard was marijuana. Marijuana given to somebody who had cancer so bad that they couldn't eat. They had nausea all day long and they couldn't sleep. And friends of theirs went to great trouble and imperiled their own criminal record, one could say, by going out and getting joints for them, grass for them. And the person said, nobody could have given me a more perfect gift. The gift that you give should be the gift that's right for that person, not another bouquet of flowers. You go into somebody's hospital room, it's filled with flowers, half of them dead. The patient doesn't need flowers. But the patient might really appreciate a cashmere throw, a pair of flannel pajamas. If you know that person, maybe they would really prefer brownies. You know, if you know that person, maybe rather than something gourmet-ish, they would have you bring something normal, like lamb chops or ice cream, to normalize them, to make them feel, you're not in this other world. I relate to you. You're still part of my real world. Books are always good. A gift certificate for some creature comfort, like a massage or one of those fancy shaves for a man. Food of all sorts is good. Ice cream, I think, is best. That's why I have two bowls of ice cream on the jacket of my book. Humor. Send jokes. I love the people who sent me a joke a day. My favorite, since I had breast cancer, I like jokes about breast cancer. I like to laugh about it as much as I can. My favorite was a cartoon of a woman standing there with her breasts sticking out like ping pong paddles. And her husband came home and opened the door and said, oh, you had a mammography today. That's the feeling that you have. I related to it. Free time. People desperately need free time. Take their child or children for an overnight or for a weekend. People want gifts that are particularly meaningful to them, like maybe frequent flyer miles for somebody who's worried about a sick parent or other relative and can't get out there to where that person lives often enough. Cash, astonishingly, a lot of people simply cannot meet their medical bills. So if you come along and make it comfortable and not humiliating, for example, give them a gift certificate for a gas station because they have to drive to their treatments. Gas station, you might as well be giving them cash, but you're not. You're saying something specific and relevant and appropriate. Like, I know you're making a lot of miles in your car going to treatments. Here's a gift certificate for a tank of gas. I think it's important to say that in terms of visits, I have a chapter about visits. Not only is it not right to just show up, that you need to ask, you need to judge the degree of illness, the circumstances, who's there. If you come there and the sick person is communing with a spouse and you've just charged in, not helpful. Also, don't assume that because you drove 20 or 25 miles to get to the sick person that therefore you have to amortize it by staying long. You don't. Usually, we really do overestimate the healing nature of our presence. The longest you should stay, in my opinion, is 20 minutes with a person who's compos mentis and not in pain. 10 minutes for somebody who's clearly in pain. You drove 25 miles, you put in your 10 minutes and you say, you know, I really have to get back, or you're looking a little tired. You become tuned in. You have to become tuned in to the particular person, the individuation, the individuality, the particularity of that person and their illness. I think it's okay to drop in to keep the caregiver company. That's different from dropping in on a patient whose condition you don't know. But if you have, as was the case with me when I went into surgery, a friend of mine insisted, my husband and I both said, don't come, we don't need it, I'm going to be in and out, which is what the surgeon said. But it didn't turn out I was in and out. Turned out I had a much longer procedure. And this friend who just dropped in to the waiting room at Sloan Kettering did a wonderful thing for my husband. She was there to reassure him. But she was there with the spouse. She didn't drop in on me once I was out of surgery. She dropped in to support him, and I think there's a very big difference. When you visit, be aware of the power differential, the fact that you're standing and the sick person is prone, the fact that you can eat anything and the sick person can't. Don't come in your yoga clothes. It's a reminder that you're healthy. They're not. Sit at eye level when someone's in a bed. Don't look down on them. Same with somebody who's in a wheelchair. This is somebody who's perfectly healthy, but they use a wheelchair. Get down to their eye level. Don't make them always look up. Sensitivity to the individual, I think, is what it's all about. And honesty brings you there. When you're visiting, be aware if you've just had a garlic pizza that you may not want to sit on the edge of their bed and talk like this. Make sure that you ask in advance, is this a convenient time? I think that these things can become sort of second nature to us once we bring consciousness to bear on all of these relationships. I'm going to close so that there's time for questions with a couple of examples from my chapter called The Best of Friends, in which I sort of highlight people who did it right. I actually learned the most from people who did it wrong, because I had those scenarios in my head, and those were things I was very careful not to duplicate. It's hard to measure up to the ideal, but it's much easier to say, here's what I'm not going to do. That's what it's going to be off limits for me. I'm not going to ever hear a word like, God only gives you as much as you can handle, come out of my mouth. I'm going to just be more filtered. But here are the people who some of them who did it right. A man who has kidney disease and cancer was a marathon swimmer and remains a marathon swimmer with the help of his compatriots, a bunch of guys who swim with him. They make sure he's okay. They swim beside him, a boat. They have a boat that goes alongside him. And he was able, this man who is on dialysis, was able to swim around Manhattan Island with the help of his friends. There's a wonderful story of a woman who was terrified of being bald. What would her life be like? How would she retain her quote, femininity, her appeal, her attractiveness? And she preemptively shaved her head so she didn't have to wake up with the hair falling out on her pillow or being in the bottom of the tub. And when her friend saw her, she said, you're beautiful. You just need a little makeup. And gave her a beautiful, exotic kind of makeup job with, you know, the eyeshadow, and perfect shading on her cheeks. And they both looked in the mirror and said, dynamite. They gave her long earrings and a very striking necklace, and then took pictures of her. And then it buoyed her up to such a degree that they decided to start a website called Bald is Beautiful. And they now have workshops that work with women who've lost their hair to increase their self-esteem and their feeling of attractiveness. So that was a wonderful kind of friendship that led to an actual, you know, enterprise. And the last example I'll give is of Bruce Feiler, who you may have read his books. He's a best-selling author. He thought he was going to die. He got cancer of his leg. He had twin girls. He was terrified. He was scared. He and his wife were just rendered incapacitated by the force of this development. It was so sudden. And his friends organized around him a full cadre of people who became the Council of Dads, who helped his daughters when he was unable to be a dad, the kind of dad he wanted to be. And they also organized the food delivery so that he didn't get 5 macaroni casseroles the same night. They organized who took him to treatments. There are wonderful ways to create collective caring. Not hard once you decide to do it. You organize it by email. Very simple. So I'm going to leave it there with my last good example, which none of us can match, or most of us can't match, and that is you can always donate a kidney for a friend, which someone I interviewed actually did. So let's hear your questions now, and thank you so much for being here. Do I see any hands? And we have to really restrict it to questions because I know we all have our illness stories, but you have to write a book to entitle yourself to tell your whole story. So a question, or I'll take a suggestion, somebody who's done it right or who's had it really go wrong, but not a full health history.
How did your family react?
Oh, my family reacted perfectly because we were just totally honest with each other. The only problem I had was how to tell my children. I know myself, and I know where my emotional fault lines are. I could not meet with my children if I had said, we're going to have a family meeting. I mean, I have grown children, married children. They have lives. They all live in New York. But if I had said, come on over to the house for a family meeting, I would have collapsed. I couldn't have faced them and said, I have cancer. I couldn't have done it. I couldn't do it on the phone because my voice wouldn't have held. So I did it by email, and they resented that. But now they understand. But at the time, they said, how can you be telling us this by email, Ma? What's the matter with you? Telling us by email. I mean, people tell us, you know, to meet on the corner by email. You're telling us about cancer. But when they realized what the alternative was for me, they understood. And my husband is the greatest man on earth, so he did nothing wrong. My mother? My mother died when I was 15, which is one of the reasons. Is that what you asked me? Yeah. First of all, I'm 70. I would be really lucky to have a mother at that age. But because my mother died when I was 15, I was very tuned in to the issue of mourning and how to relate to bereaved people. I will never forget kids in my class who acted as if I was a leper, wouldn't go near me, because then, you know, their mother might die. It could be catching. And there were kids in my class who just were perfect, who were comforting and who said they were sorry and told the truth about their emotional reaction to me. And there were kids in my class who never, ever mentioned it again. And variations of that exact pattern, those exact patterns, exist in adult life, but I'll never forget them from that period. Just let me ask you, how many people in this audience don't have any friend or relative who's sick? I rest my case. This needs to be discussed. Over there, please.
Was your faith or your rabbi helpful to you?
Does my faith or my rabbi help me? I did not confide in my rabbi. I have three rabbis, actually. I do have three rabbis. I belong to a huge synagogue called B'nai Jeshurun in New York. So I have three rabbis, and they're friends of mine. I didn't choose to tell them. I really didn't feel I needed that kind of solace. I was on a trajectory where I really felt that I wasn't a terrible case and I could get through this without that kind of pastoral care. But my religion helped me because even though I felt it was really unfair after Yom Kippur when I confessed everything and I had a completely clean slate, I had not done one thing wrong, and then I get cancer the next day, even though that happened. I do feel that the rituals of my faith are extremely helpful, especially what we have a blessing called the Shehechiyanu, which is the blessing over time. I say Shehechiyanu over almost anything that's wonderful. It's meant to be said over at weddings and at bar mitzvahs, at happy occasions. The first fruit of the season, the first rainbow you see this year. There are wonderful settings in which you're supposed to say the Shehechiyanu blessing. I have appropriated it as my gratitude blessing, the blessing that I'm still here, the blessing that I've gotten, you know, 3.5 years, and everything seems fine. Yes. Wait, we need to put you on the stage. We need to do the Phil Donahue Oprah thing here.
Speaking personally, I find it most difficult to deal with people who say nothing.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any advice on that?
People who say nothing are people who are deeply threatened in a very personal way. Your illness has touched their vulnerability and their fear, and they don't know what to say, So rather than put their foot in their mouth, they say nothing. I would be sort of tolerant and maybe help them, you know, maybe say something about, you know, I'm feeling so much better, or I'm on new meds, and something that opens it up, that makes it okay for the person to come in. Or maybe they need to say nothing. Maybe they really just can't engage on this issue. It's too disturbing for them. So much of the interaction between the sick and the well has to do with how the well feel and how the well want to feel better. They want to feel better. That's why we end up reassuring them, I'm going to be okay. You know, they start to cry in front of you, and you have to say, I'm going to be okay, or it's okay, or just be with me through this. You know, don't worry about it. You can cry, but don't worry about it because I'm dealing with it. You know, I've got doctors, I've got a treatment, I've got the right meds. And make that, you have to make them feel better at times. And sometimes saying nothing is the best they can do. Yes. You. Yes, you need it. Because made for the microphone because they're taping this or Twittering it or something.
I have two questions. One is, how did your friendships with the people who let you down survive or not? And the other question is, did any of your respondents talk about how their physicians may have let them down? Was there any discussion of that issue, or was that sort of outside the purview of your... Well,
it was the discussion, the question about, I'll start with the second question about did the physicians let you down. That was not within my purview, but people volunteered those stories, and some of them were blood-curdling, where once it was clear that the physician's efforts were going to fail, the physician had to distance him or herself, couldn't deal with it. That, you know, I'm a healer, but I'm not somebody who knows how to deal with you dying. That's why the hospice movement has been so marvelous, because there really are doctors who only know how to heal. They don't know how to comfort. They don't know how to just be with. I had an experience myself where I had years and years ago, I was really like in my 30s, and I had strange stomach pains, and I decided I'd get a new gynecologist. And she said, well, you know, we have to test, we have to this, it looks this, it might be that. I said, well, what's the downside of this? She said, the downside, you could die. Which, you know, maybe I wanted to hear, but not quite like that, not like in that dismissive, how stupid can you be to ask that question, but maybe in a gentle way. She could have said, well, you know, the worst case scenario is it's bad, but we have a million things to do between now and bad. There are ways to couch it. Your first question, how did my friendships weather some of this behavior? I had the one woman who didn't refer to it, who knew about it, but didn't refer to it, although I saw her 3-4 times a month. I figured out why she was like that, and then I forgave her. I know this woman for 40 years, and I said, why would she pay attention to my body when she doesn't pay attention to her own? She's somebody who didn't have a mammogram till she was 60. She didn't never had a pap smear until she, you know, had a suspicious thing happen. Who doesn't go to the doctor when she has the flu, you know, toughs it out. Who doesn't wear sunblock? You know, that's the way she is. She's in denial of her physical self. Why would I expect her to ask me or follow my situation? It's too scary for her. She doesn't want to deal with it. She deals with strength, not with weakness. So I rolled right over it with her. She hasn't said anything to me to this day. Through my treatment, through my surgery, nothing. She didn't ask if she could come and see me, nothing. And it's fine, because that's who she is. The people who gossiped, who kind of just kept this alive, the metastasis I mentioned, I really had to speak kind of firmly to them, and I said at one point, I have to nip this in the bud, or actually in full flower, because it was so out of control, that 3 months after my diagnosis, when I was finally gaining control of my emotions, which takes some doing, and the worst thing you feel is out of control when you're sick, powerless, So gaining control of my emotions was one thing I actually had mastered. And then, this is 3 months after my diagnosis, I get an email from a wonderful woman, lives 1,000 miles away, but I see her rarely, and when I do, it's very warm. And she was someone who had breast cancer. And her email was the one that threw me into a tailspin, where I was right back where I started. Her email said, "Oh, Letty," was an O without an H. It was like a Shakespearean tragedy O. "Oh, Letty, you always were so youthful and energetic. I can't believe this happened to you." Now, again, with the golden rule or the Hillel, do not do unto others what you would not want them to do unto you, measure. She could have said to herself, would this make me feel good, you know, to hear that? Well, for me, it was like youthful and energetic is who I am. That's how I saw myself. I mean, I hike, I bike, I see myself as youthful and energetic. And she was saying it in a way that kind of was, you'll never again be youthful and energetic. I can't believe it happened to you. What did you do wrong? If it could happen to you, it could happen to, you know, I could get mine again. It was so much, there was so much subtext there that we were going out for the evening and I ran into the shower, to sob because I didn't want my husband to, you know, start getting involved and worrying about me. I'm sobbing in the shower and I guess I must have been very, very loud. He came and took me out of the shower and he's already dressed. I completely soused his shirt and suit and tie and everything. But that was my greatest moment of real collapse, my greatest moment. And it was only her words. So did I tell her that it was her words? No, because she was simply burbling out what she felt and what she thought. She saw me this way. My goodness, was I never going to be that way again? She didn't have that momentary beat, the filter, the rereading of the email to make sure. I did stop some people, as I said, and nipped it in the flower, and their abject apologies. "Oh, I'm so sorry I told so-and-so. I thought she knew. I just thought she knew, and I would never have carried this tale if I... So sorry, so sorry, so sorry." And by that time, I was so sorry that I had scolded. Not scolded, but, you know, begrudged her. You know, it was sort of like not worth it to make her feel so bad. So a lot gets put on us, you know, to solve the problems of our friends. Yes, back there.
I just want to thank you for your honesty, and I'm really glad that you're here, and I followed your career sort of. I'm a women's studies major, so I just want to thank you for all the books that you've written, for even having daughters that are writers, and it's just been an amazing journey, and I'm glad that you survived it. And what do you think helped you the most in fighting this or in surviving? Like, what made you laugh?
Mm-hmm. Besides the jokes I got every day from some of my friends, I guess what really made it possible for me to get through this and to even recover from the "Oh, Letty," which I did that evening, but with a lot of heavy lifting in the psyche, was really realizing that the best treatment for me was normalization. So I walked to my radiation every day. I made it my business from West 67th Street between Columbus and Central Park West to East 67th Street and the river on the east side. I walked through the park. I walked in the rain. I walked in the snow. I walked in a blizzard. I made it my business to walk every single day there and back. That made me feel normal. That made me feel I was not in the land of the sick. And the normalization of work, I kept writing. I was lucky, very lucky, in that the radiation didn't make me tired. Many of my compatriots got very tired and needed to nap during the day. I didn't. I got lucky on both the fact that I had a lumpectomy and that I didn't have debilitating radiation. But I had to deal with the psyche. I had to deal with the knowledge that something had invaded my body. I'm this healthy person. I don't have any symptoms. And I have cancer. How can that be? It's surrealism in everyday life to know that something can go on in your body and you not know it. especially when you're very tuned in, which a lot of us are very tuned in. We know our bodies. So to normalize myself, to keep the same schedule, to go out, to listen to music, to go to the theater, and not let myself get in the doldrums and not let myself focus on whether the 11 nodes were going to be positive. I needed a lot of help to get through the 10 days while I was waiting for the report from the pathologist. I did a lot of retail therapy. I did. I went shopping like a loony bird. I just went out and bought one of everything. You know why? Well, it's obvious why. I needed to buy things to realize, to persuade myself I'd be alive to wear them or use them, that I could amortize the rest of my life over the expenses that I've just put out. You know, and it's like the guy who won't, you know, the 90-year-old who won't buy green bananas. Like, you know, he might not be able to eat them and justify the expense. Well, I did the opposite. I wanted to buy a lot of things so that I could convince myself I had a life ahead of me in which to use them. The retail therapy was very, very helpful, and I admit it. And I'm not basically a major shopper, but I have a lot of clothes I don't need as a result of 3.5 years ago waiting for my my report on these 11 nodes. Okay, one more. Yes, why don't we take two more, because I saw two hands. Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're the other. You're the second one.
Hi, and I also appreciate the work that you've been doing through all these years.
Thank you.
Did anybody during this time, whether it's friends or family, simply come to you and say, I need your advice. I need you to tell me how to be with you?
No, I wish they had. I wish somebody had done that, because that's where I end up here. I end up wishing that we could have that conversation with everybody in our lives who has anything they're dealing with. If we could just start at that level and say, I want to be here for you, but I don't really know what to do. I don't know what I'm going to say that's going to be annoying to you. I want to be helpful. I want to do the right thing, but I'm going to sometimes need your help. That changes everything. And if somebody had come to me and said, I need your advice on how to treat you, I would have told them, don't drop in. Don't visit as often. Don't call me every other day. Don't remind me that I'm sick. I'm trying to get past it. Don't say, you look great, because I know I don't look great. You know, I'm having treatments and I'm scared and I'm not sleeping and I don't look great. So don't lie to me, because we both know it's a lie. And don't feed me any cliches. I would say that if they asked. I'd like to have had the freedom to say to somebody, please stop talking about me, you know. Instead, it had to come to that moment when I berated somebody and then she was so sorry, I was sorry I did it. But I wish I could have just had that basic honesty to begin with. There was one more right here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your honesty. This lecture is in honor of my mother, and she would have actually very much appreciated your honesty. She had a very similar approach. And I know there's a lot of mixed emotions about this, but I'm curious to know how you felt towards any outpouring you might have received of pink ribbons and all of the associated popular paraphernalia. And I hate to say that, because I know many people are very involved in pink ribbons, and I'd be curious to hear your feedback. I sort of know where my mother stood on that.
I don't know where your mother stood, but I'm grateful that there's a lecture series in her honor, in her memory. I'm not a pink ribbon person. I'm suspicious of it. I know that, a ridiculously small percentage of the money raised goes actually to cancer research. It goes to, quote, education, which really perpetuates itself. I don't know, more pink ribbons and more football players wearing pink jerseys and more, you know, supermarkets with a pink flag out front. But not going, I give my money to the Breast Cancer Research Council. That's the place where it's going straight into Breast Cancer Research Foundation. It goes straight into research. It goes straight into the doctor's hands, the ones who are discovering you can treat through genes, that some of it's a mutation, the incredible work that's being done to tailor treatment directly to a particular kind of breast cancer or sell. I think that's where the money should be going and not into parades and floats. So I don't do that. But the beginning of your question, I wanted to ask it. What was I wanted to answer?
Thank you for your honesty.
Oh, I know.
Thank
you. Thank you so much. I'm honored that you say so. And thank you all so much for coming and for your questions.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.